Nuclear cover-ups. It's one thing to say that nuclear power is not the solution to climate change, but that verifiable fact has been ignored in the face of a deluge of techniques used by the nuclear industry to justify and promote its very existence. How is it that this industry, nuclear, gets away with its outrageous claims and denials of harm without accountability? Is it indicative of a deeper level of injustice that runs the world? It takes a genuine expert on not only the science, but the political, social, and media issues surrounding this dangerous technology to boil it down to the basics. And when he tells you,
The larger society, it's not specific to nuclear energy. It is to how our society is structured in such an unequal fashion with gross inequalities of wealth and power, and how the people who are wealthy use the wealth to get power to get things done the way they want, while at the same time passing on the costs and the risks to the vast majority of the public.
well, when an expert physicist explains not only what the nuclear industry is getting away with, but the many ways at play with which they accomplish it, while also giving us the greater truth about nuclear dangers that give lie to the industry's lies about being the solution to climate change, you get another set of angles on that dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at 3 Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, the first of a two-part interview with physicist M. V. Ramana on his new book, Nuclear is Not the Solution: The Folly of Atomic Power in the Age of Climate Change. It's a well-written, insightful, level-headed, and extremely accessible explanation of everything that's wrong with current thinking about nuclear, and a book that deserves to be on all the bookshelves of those who oppose this dangerous technology. We will also have nuclear news from around the world. Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, Alistair Burnett reporting from the Geneva, Switzerland-based headquarters of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons on what's been happening with the treaty in the past month, Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than was mentioned during the U.S. vice presidential debate. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, October 2nd, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., Hurricane Helene's storm surge along Florida's western edges is being called the most devastating since 1921. Hit by the floodwaters was the shut-down Duke Energy Corporation nuclear power plant near Crystal River, about 40 miles north of Clearwater. Bloomberg News reported that the facility, which has been closed since 2013, took on a storm surge as deep as 12 feet. What's interesting is that Duke Energy filed a report with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency saying that radioactive material was not released. However, later in this same article by Bloomberg, it says that the whole site was flooded, including buildings, sumps, and lift stations, and industrial wastewater pond number 5 was observed overflowing to the ground due to the surge. The report from Duke went on to say, quote, "We are still in the process of obtaining access and assessing the damage. But due to the nature of this event, we anticipate difficulty with estimating the total discharge amount of wastewater, and impacts are unknown at this time," end quote. So they're giving it an all clear on any possible release of radioactive material stored on site before they can actually get on site and obtain an accurate report on the damage. Here with more on the climate crisis Hurricane Helene nuclear connection is Linda Pence-Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
As no one can have failed to notice, our country has been ravaged once again by violent weather extremes. This past weekend from Hurricane Helene, which has left areas in the south submerged and destroyed and led to a number of deaths. And yet, as my partner in crime at Beyond Nuclear and also on the home front, Paul Gunter, pointed out, these events are being described as biblical, even though it should be obvious by now that our ever more frequent climatic disasters are entirely human-caused. Acts of God, whether you are a believer or not, have absolutely nothing to do with it. Try telling that to our political leaders. No matter who wins in November, we are looking at drilling or fracking or both. And of course, more nuclear power. The fact that all of these will obviously make the climate crisis far worse, far faster, does not pass these people by. They know it, and they do it anyway, submitting willingly to the bidding of their corporate paymasters who would rather celebrate near-term greed and gain than leave a livable world to their children and grandchildren. This means we are led by criminals who go not only unpunished, but who are routinely re-elected. That's why I admire and applaud activists from groups like Just Stop Oil. While the rest of us sit at home stating the obvious on Facebook, and right here too, they are out there sacrificing their freedom to draw attention to the utter, inarguable urgency of doing something right now to save ourselves from extinction. Tellingly, Just Stop Oil, painted by the corporate media as vandals, has a quote from the head of one of the world's most established institutions on its website. "We cannot save a burning planet with a fire hose of fossil fuels. The 1.5 degree limit is only possible if we ultimately stop burning all fossil fuels, not reduce, not abate." Those words were spoken by Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations. Last Friday, a friend of mine, Ludi Simpson, was arrested at London's National Gallery after he and two other Just Stop Oil activists splashed tomato soup on the same glass-enclosed Van Gogh sunflowers painting that was hit 2 years ago, commanding headlines around the world. The two young women responsible for that action were convicted last Friday, just hours before Ludi and his friends repeated the protest. In sentencing them to a combined 3 years and 8 months, the judge scolded the pair for coming, quote, within the thickness of a pane of glass of irreparably damaging or even destroying this priceless treasure. But what about that priceless treasure called planet Earth? All of Van Gogh's paintings and everything else we care about will be irreparably lost if we don't take urgent action on climate now. That's precisely the point. Climate activists don't hate art. They don't even actually damage it. They want to save it and us. It would be good to have a Just Stop Nukes action group now too, given the absurd insistence on pursuing yet more nuclear power in the name of climate and wasting our money and precious time to boot. But my mantra is never to call for something you are not willing to do yourself. Unlike my courageous and principled friend Ludi and those who similarly protest nuclear weapons in the plowshares movement, I am not quite ready to step into a jail cell just yet for 2 years or more. But what we can do instead is lend our loudest possible support to those who are, whether it's about fossil fuels or nuclear power or nuclear weapons. It's all part of the same story, our collective survival. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
In Arizona, the Pinyon Plain Mine, formerly the Canyon Mine, is located less than 10 miles from the south rim of the Grand Canyon and is within the ancestral footprints of the Grand Canyon National Monument. Now, the U.S. Forest Service says it could be open to conducting a new environmental assessment of the uranium mine after Arizona's governor and attorney general urged the agency to study the mine's possible impacts. This reevaluation would have the purpose of determining whether there are substantial new circumstances or information about the significance of adverse effects which may be caused by this mine. It has long been opposed by the Havasupai people an indigenous tribe that states that the mine has polluted the only source of clean drinking water on their ancestral lands. Another danger with the Pinyon Plain mine, which needs to be evaluated, is their plan to ship uranium ore to the White Mesa Mill in Utah for processing. This would involve trucking the ore through Arizona, Navajo Nation, Utah, and the Ute Mountain Ute Reservation. A recent analysis of fatal accidents along the haul route shows an elevated risk along long stretches, especially on Navajo Nation, in places between 240% and 700% more dangerous than on an average stretch of road in the United States per mile driven. In late August, Navajo Nation passed emergency legislation to tighten regulations on uranium ore transport across their lands. Meanwhile, a representative of the mine's owner, Energy Fuels Resources, dismissed the new rules as, quote, a little excessive, end quote, and said the company doesn't expect to be required to follow them. More shall be revealed. In D.C., activists for victims of the nation's nuclear development and testing programs descended on Washington again last week in hopes of pushing forward legislation to renew and expand RECA, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which remains stalled in Congress. Lawmakers and advocates urged Speaker Mike Johnson to hold a vote on the Senate-passed bill from Senator Josh Hawley, contending the bill would easily pass if brought to the floor, a move that was actively blocked by Speaker Johnson last June and which allowed it to expire. The bill would reauthorize and update the 1990 Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which provides financial compensation and medical screening to those downwind of nuclear testing, as well as those exposed and sickened through uranium mining and exposure to waste. It would also expand claims to a greater number of downwinders and open the fund to residents of Guam and veterans who handled waste in the Marshall Islands. And if the Department of Defense has its way, coming soon to anywhere near you, a portable nuclear reactor. The DOD has broken ground at Idaho National Laboratories on Project Pele, a transportable nuclear reactor. The proposed reactor is being manufactured by BWXT, the company formerly known as Babcock & Wilcox, which was the company behind the melted-down nuclear reactor at Three Mile Island. The current schedule includes transport of the fully assembled reactor to Idaho National Laboratories in 2026. And we will link to an article by Stephen H. Wodka, Karen Silkwood and Kerr McGee, A Reinvestigation. For those unfamiliar with the story, in 1974, Karen Silkwood and her union, the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers, were engaged in a confrontation with her employer, the Kerr McGee Corporation, and its regulator, the Atomic Energy Commission. On November 5th, Silkwood became contaminated with plutonium and died in a car crash a few days later. 50 years later, even after repeated investigations, the basic questions on how these events occurred have gone unanswered. There has never been a dispute that plutonium from Kerr McGee's nuclear fuel manufacturing plant in Crescent, Oklahoma, had escaped and contaminated Silkwood's apartment. However, Lawrence J. Olson Sr., the FBI agent placed in charge of the Silkwood investigation, failed to treat anyone associated with the plant with suspicion, except for Silkwood. This is an extensive article, and we will link to it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 693. Over to Japan, where Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, operator of the Kashiwazaki Kariwa nuclear plant in Niigata Prefecture, has sent 69 spent fuel assemblies from that facility to Japan's interim storage facility in Mutsu, Aomori Prefecture. The interim storage facility, set up with a joint investment from TEPCO and Japan Atomic Power Company, can store up to 5,000 tons of spent nuclear fuel for up to 50 years. But there are already concerns that the storage period will be exceeded, as the next step in their planned process, a nuclear fuel recycling plant due to be built in Rokkasho, also in Aomori, has yet to be completed. Meanwhile, More nuclear waste keeps being produced every day those reactors are in operation, and 50 years is a drop in the bucket compared to the half-life of the plutonium in the spent fuel rods, which is 24,000 years. As the nuclear industry is infamous for having its facilities take longer to build and cost more than anticipated, it's already a race against the clock for that recycling plant to be built before the amount of waste that needs to be sent there exceeds its capacity. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
They say an army marches on its stomach, and so does the Japanese nuclear industry's inexorable march towards normalizing the exportation of food from Fukushima and the rest of Japan to the rest of the world. Last week, we reported on a softening of Chinese restrictions against the import of fish and seafood from Fukushima and adjacent prefectures. This was a surprise because China, along with Russia, has held the strongest objections to the possibly radiation-contaminated food after Japan began its regular releases of radioactive tritium-contaminated water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean. Now Taiwan has eased import restrictions on foods from 5 Japanese prefectures, including Fukushima, as of last Wednesday, September 25. This includes mushrooms, game meat, and koshiabora, a mountain vegetable from Fukushima. Japanese Minister of Agriculture, Forestry, and Fisheries said in a statement that Taiwan's move is, quote, a positive move that supports reconstruction in disaster-affected areas, end quote. No word on additional medical support, as the possible impact of eating food exposed to radioactivity becomes progressively more evident in the public that consumes it. And TEPCO is proceeding with its full-court press to get Fukushima foods eaten around the world. They're holding various food events in the U.S. and U.K., promoting Fukushima produce and Japanese scallops. These events were only started last year after the first release of the radioactive tritium-contaminated wastewater from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean, this over protest from around the world. In Seattle, supermarkets are selling Fukushima-grown rice, and select restaurants are using Fukushima-grown rice to make their signature dishes. In California and 11 other states, Mitsuha Marketplace stores are selling Japanese scallops, and food booths sold scallop skewers and fried scallops at New York's Japan Fest. And in the UK, 5 events are pushing Fukushima-grown peaches and Shine Muscat grapes. Luxury department store Harrods is selling a box of 3 Fukushima peaches for £80, about US$106. What no one seems to understand is that the impact of eating food contaminated with radiation is not immediate. You're not about to keel over and die while you eat a Fukushima peach, unless it's in response to their price. But over time, there can be health impacts. And by the time cancer, autoimmune diseases, or other radiation illnesses show up, the distance between cause and effect is such that they'll forget the peach they ate in 2024 as they slide into their next round of chemo. And that's why TEPCO, Japan's Ministry of Agriculture, Forestry, and Fisheries, and all their enablers who lifted restrictions to sell, 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 you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
And meanwhile, Japan has begun the 9th round of discharge of radioactive tritium-contaminated wastewater from the Fukushima nuclear power plant into the Pacific Ocean. While TEPCO has said that analysis of samples collected from tanks at the plant showed the levels of radioactive substances, including tritium, were below the standard limit, that begs the question, who sets the limits? What are they based on? And is this a safe decision? And we will link to an article by the Citizens Nuclear Information Center of Japan that enumerates their concerns over the revival of the nuclear power myth and unrealistic nuclear policy, focusing on comments on nuclear power in the Liberal Democratic Party presidential election and the Constitutional Democratic Party of Japan representative election. Check out the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 693. In Russia, in mid-September, the Kremlin described as dangerous comment by Jens Stoltenberg, the outgoing head of NATO, that a decision by the West to allow Ukraine to use Western long-range weapons to strike Russia would not be a red line that would prompt an escalation by Moscow. Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky has been pleading with allies for months to let Ukraine fire Western missiles into Russia to limit Moscow's ability to launch attacks. Stoltenberg dismissed a warning by Russian President Vladimir Putin that letting Ukraine use such weapons to strike deep inside Russian territory would mean the West was directly fighting Russia. Stoltenberg, the outgoing head of NATO, whose term ends in October, dismissed the warnings as, quote, "There have been many red lines declared by Putin before, and he has not escalated," meaning also involving NATO allies directly in the conflict, end quote. But Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said, "This ostentatious desire not to take seriously the Russian president's statements is a move that is completely short-sighted and unprofessional," and labeled Stoltenberg's position as extremely provocative and dangerous. A week later, Putin's point man for arms control, Andrei Sinitsyn, said Russia's nuclear test site at Novaya Zemlya is ready for resumption of full-scale testing, but Russia will not test a nuclear weapon as long as the United States refrains from testing. Putin has also said that he has no need to use such weapons to win the war in Ukraine. But the war of words has been heating up because on September 28, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov told the United Nations that the West is in danger of trying to, quote, "fight to victory with a nuclear power," end quote. Russia invaded Ukraine in February of 2022. 9 months later, December 2022, Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky announced a 10-point peace plan to bring a just end to the war on the basis of the founding UN Charter and international law. Moscow rejected the plan and warns that it was senseless to ignore alternatives to Ukraine's peace proposals. This public war of words continues, and let's hope that it does not escalate beyond the use of incendiary language. And the Pentagon has confirmed a report that China's newest nuclear-powered attack submarine sank this past spring. A U.S. Defense Department spokesperson told the Japan Times, on condition of anonymity, that the submarine sank pierside. "It's unclear if it was carrying nuclear fuel at the time," the spokesperson said. No word on what might have happened to that nuclear fuel. Now here's our monthly ICAN update from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons.
This is Alistair Burnett at ICAN in Geneva, and here's our roundup of September's news from the campaign. The big news for the month is that we're now only one country away from having a majority of states at the UN as full-blown members or signatories to the Nuclear Ban Treaty, the TPNW. On the 24th of September, three more countries ratified the treaty and one more signed it at a high-level ceremony at the UN General Assembly. That means 98 countries out of 197 that are eligible to join are now on board. Also this month, ICAN coordinated a global week of action highlighting how much money is wasted on nuclear weapons, $91 billion last year alone. And we were asking campaigners what that money should be spent on instead. There were more than 50 actions all over the world, including rallies, signature drives, teach-ins, webinars, and protests at banks and on the streets. We also saw daily online action hours against nuclear weapons from our partners at nuclearban.us. As the goal was to raise awareness of the opportunity cost of nuclear weapons to other issues, we also worked with environmental campaigners and social media influencers to spread the message that nuclear weapons are connected to the other major threats to our future, like climate change and the destruction of the natural world. Back to the growing strength of the TPNW. At the centre of our work at the UN is Seth Sheldon. He's ICAN's UN liaison based in New York. I asked him how these ratifications come together.
A country becomes party to the treaty, or becomes, we say, a state party, by submitting an instrument of accession or an instrument of ratification to the United Nations. They can also first sign the treaty to express its intent to later ratify. these conversations that are happening, especially whether or not to sign a treaty, are ultimately just people making decisions, if that isn't obvious. But when you see it in action, it becomes much more obvious. And it is also true that conversations with other people, and they might be leaders, they might be campaigners from ICANN or others who are supportive of the treaty, help people make even sometimes last minute decisions to take an action. And so it can be very dramatic.
And speaking of drama, how close are we to getting that majority of states having signed or ratified the treaty?
Yeah, it's an exciting moment for the TPNW. We are essentially at the halfway mark of states that could sign or ratify the treaty having done so. So on Tuesday, Solomon Islands became the newest state to take a treaty action and joined Indonesia and Sierra Leone in becoming parties to the treaty. That means that we have 98 states that have signed or ratified the treaty. So the next state to sign it or become party will bring us into a global majority of states that can do so, having done so.
And that could happen any time.
It could happen anytime, but the reason that these ceremonies are important, in reality, leaders tend to look for opportunities that get a lot of attention or a big moment to take these kind of actions. And that, of course, includes the high level week, the opening of the UN General Assembly in New York every September. So we try to build enthusiasm for these kind of ceremony programs to encourage states to use them to take an action and to do that hard thing of committing to disarmament in a world where many states are undoing those kind of commitments or at least not being very helpful.
So, speaking of countries being unhelpful, when do you envisage or when do you think it's possible that a nuclear armed state or a what we call an umbrella state that supports the use of nuclear weapons in its own defense, when one of them might sign the treaty?
Well, I cannot give a specific date, but I am confident that it will happen. And to me, the real question is whether it happens before or after there's a great disaster. We have always seen states do things when they perceive it in their interest to do so. It includes historical moves towards disarmament from the very countries that, we are saying will never do it in some spaces, like US and Russia. The vast majority of the world realizes that nuclear weapons do not provide a military advantage. They do not provide security. They may enable more violence than they could ever prevent. And the vast majority of the world knows that nuclear weapons are immoral, they're indiscriminate, they're civilization-ending threats, and now they're illegal. So I believe it's working, and thus I believe that it will happen. When they join, no one can predict that at the moment, but I believe we are moving in that direction.
That was Seth Sheldon, ICANN's UN liaison, talking to me from New York. And this is Alistair Burnett, ending September's news roundup for Nuclear Hot Seat.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, I know you care about getting honest nuclear news, and that's what we set out to provide here at Nuclear Hot Seat every week. Verifiable nuclear information that's been sourced, checked, and footnoted, plus interviews with people who are genuine experts on various aspects of the nuclear industry and its impact on life, health, and our shared genetic future. We also tell you about people on the front lines of activism around the world, their triumphs, challenges, and how you can help them. We get underneath the manicured exterior of mainstream media's nuclear stories to provide context and continuity because we want you to understand what the issues are, what we are up against, and what any of us can do about it. But this show cannot survive without your support. So if you're grateful for the information you get from Nuclear Hot Seat, now is the time to help us out. We run on donations, and right now, quite frankly, our expenses are far outstripping what we've been sent. So if you've ever thought of donating to Nuclear Hot Seat as a good idea, but you haven't done so yet, now is the exact right time to get it going. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. And we make it easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Any amount is welcomed. You can make this a one-time donation or an ongoing recurring one, be it $5, $500, $5,000. All amounts are welcome. So don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate right now. And know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. It's always great when new books get published about nuclear, and there have been several that we will be covering in the coming weeks. Right now, I want to bring your attention to an important new book that has just been published by M.V. Ramana. It's entitled, Nuclear is Not the Solution: The Folly of Atomic Power in the Age of Climate Change. In it, this much-lauded physicist has laid out the case against nuclear in clear, concise, easy-to-understand language, which means he's an important interviewee for Nuclear Hot Seat. Ramana has a ton of credentials. Among them, he is Professor and Simmons Chair of Disarmament, Global, and Human Security at the University of British Columbia, a member of the International Panel on Fissile Materials, the Canadian Pugwash Group, International Nuclear Risk Assessment Group, and he may be familiar to Nuclear Hot Seat listeners as a member of the team that produces the annual World Nuclear Industry Status Report. Note that early in the interview, there are repeated references to the Vogtle nuclear reactors, which are in Georgia, and the never-completed nuclear boondoggle of the VC Summer reactors in South Carolina. I spoke with Ramana on Friday, September 27, 2024. M.V. Ramana, it is so great and such an honor to have you with us this morning on Nuclear Hot Seat.
The honor is mine, Libby. I'm so full of admiration for all the work you've been doing over the many, many years. Thank you so much.
And thank you. I'd like to start out with a quote from the introduction in your book, Nuclear is Not the Solution. This is where you state that your book's, quote, deeper purpose is to demonstrate through the example of nuclear energy why it is important to understand that the climate catastrophe to be as much a crisis of political economy as it is a crisis of ecology resulting from technological choices. There's a lot to unpack in that. Can you give us an overview as to what you mean?
In a way, the book started with my asking what seems like a puzzle to many of us, which is we know that nuclear energy is expensive, it takes a lot of time, it's risky, we don't know how to deal with the radioactive waste it produces, and it's linked with nuclear weapons. We know all of those for decades now. Why is it that governments and corporations are still investing in this technology? Why are they promoting it? That was the fundamental question that I started with. And, you know, as you might see in the book, four of the chapters have to deal with that. The first two chapters are sort of a cataloging of things that at least people who are listening to your program would know only too well. And to me, all of that, whatever I learned in those trying to understand that question, is speaking to the larger society. It's not specific to nuclear energy. It is to how our society is structured in such an unequal fashion, with gross inequalities of wealth and power, and how the people who are wealthy use the wealth to get power to get things done the way they want, while at the same time passing on the costs and the risks to the vast majority of the public. And so this is something which we are going to be seeing even if we are thinking about other technologies, be it oil and gas and coal, or even renewables. Right, many of the bad environmental impacts of it and the health impacts of it are outsourced to disempowered communities around the world. Think of where the solar panels might be getting dumped. Think of where the materials for which come from and what are the kind of horrendous conditions under which people mine those things. And they are all indicative of the political economy of our society rather than the technology per se.
Well, that takes care of my first five questions. okay, let me just edit this down too. One of the quotes you use that struck me is from Noam Chomsky. And he said, what you have is a system of socialization cost and risk and privatization of profit. How have a handful of large and financially powerful organizations profited from building and operating nuclear power plants at the public's expense?
Now, let's take the example of the latest power plant that has started operating in the United States, the Vogtle plant. In the book, I document, and I, you know, have to rely completely on activists on the ground in Georgia who are documenting all of this work. And I mention all of them, the groups in the book. They have shown how Georgia Power's profits jumped immediately after the legislative act that allowed Georgia Power to pass on costs to customers. I'll back up and explain a little bit about how the electricity sector in the United States is structured.
Please do.
Historically, the way that the electricity sector has been structured was to allow companies that were supplying electricity to charge customers whatever they are spending, plus a profit margin. So every year, the company would say, here are all our expenses. These are our capital expenses. These are our operating expenses. And we spent, let's say, $100 million. And we want permission to charge the customers X cents per kilowatt hour so that the amount that we are charging is adequate to pay back all of the expenses that we have, plus a profit margin. This has been a well-known problem in the electricity sector, in that if a company finds a way to pass on some costs, it's to their benefit, right? They can gold plate their projects and pass on the costs, as long as they're allowed to pass on the costs. And the people who allow them to pass on the costs are some regulatory body, sort of a public utilities commission. So the public utilities commission historically have also been compromised in various ways. There is regulatory capture. People who go in and out of these bodies try to then promote the interests of the companies rather than the public, even though they're supposed to be public utilities commission. You know this, as, and most of your readers, listeners probably know about this, in the case of Georgia, where the utilities commission has been completely taken over. Now, what changed in Georgia and also in South Carolina, where the only other recent project sort of started, was that the companies were allowed by legislation to charge customers even before the nuclear reactor was constructed. So as the construction process started, the bills of these customers went up without any guarantee that they were actually going to get some rewards for that extra cost. And the place where that whole arrangement meant that even though the project was canceled after over $9 billion was spent, customers are still getting charged for it, for electricity they never saw, essentially for a big hole in the ground there. In Georgia, on the other hand, the reactor was completed at an enormous cost increase, and yet the customers were paying not what they originally were told it was going to be costing, but actually for the, all the extra costs that were spent. But the profits for this went to the owners of the stocks, the financial companies that were owning money or were investing in this project, and to all of the executives in the company. So in South Carolina, again, for the failed project, many of these executives got what were called golden parachutes, where even if the project was to be abandoned, they would get millions of dollars as bonuses. So there are lots of ways in which this arrangement incentivizes companies to A, invest in very expensive projects, in this case, nuclear power plants, and continue with the project, even though it is very apparent that the project was not going to be on time, on budget, or deliver electricity. And this is actually, you can even go further back. The incentive to promote a nuclear project when it was already clear that renewables were much cheaper was also present. It was because of these incentives that utilities were not trying to find out what is the cheapest way to supply electricity, what is the most efficient and the quickest way to supply electricity, and what is the cleanest way. None of that they are interested in, because there's the economic incentives all way in light or in line with them making huge amounts of money if for expensive projects.
You do an extensive and scathing analysis of South Carolina's scandal over the never-built or never completed VC summer nuclear reactors. And as you mentioned earlier, you highlight that the warnings were given against the project by activist groups, environmental groups such as Friends of the Earth, and that all of these warnings were ignored, even though they eventually proved not only accurate, but prescient. They predicted what was going to happen with tremendous accuracy. Could you explain how in the world the voice of reason gets drowned out in these hearings and the bad path is almost invariably chosen?
There are very powerful interests who benefit from going down this wrong path. I already talked about the case of utility companies. In the case of the legislature and so on, though it's not necessarily clear in South Carolina, in other states, we have seen major corruption scandals. In the case of Ohio, is the most egregious of that, in the case of First Energy. There are interests for legislators also to actually pass on these costs to customers. And the customers and their representatives, the civil society organizations and the environmental organizations, including Friends of the Earth in the case of South Carolina, and activists like Tom Clements, have very little capacity to influence these people in comparison with all of these very moneyed interests. They don't have the lobbying capacity. They don't have the capacity to go and wine and dine all these people, right? All you can do is to show up at hearings and try to put in your testimony, go have demonstrations, write letters, write op-eds, but they can all be ignored by legislators because they are not fundamentally accountable. And this is, I think, again, one of those questions about larger political economy, larger society.
One of the things that I have found most frustrating, and it happens across the board, is that the media lead with the nuclear industry's perspective and talking points. And of course, that's reinforced by World Nuclear News from the World Nuclear Association. And it's like, accepted truth is not true when it comes to the media's reporting. Do you have any insights on how those of us who oppose nuclear and have the truth, such as when Friends of the Earth were speaking it, or any of the activist groups speaking to public utilities commissions, or here in California, the Coastal Commission, or the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, do you have any insights on how we might be better and more powerful in putting our points across?
Yeah. Maybe this question needs to be rephrased because I don't have an answer for that, right? I mean, we are all struggling with it and we are getting our asses kicked on so many different fronts. So yes, we need to do something different. I don't think I know really the answer. Set of things that I do, you know, I write op-eds, I write books, I go and talk to people, to, you know, groups, to civil society organizations, things of that sort. But in the larger scheme of things, we are not able to shift the needle. The forces that are against us are so powerful. The only thing we have on our side are facts and a lot of committed people who seem to be very sincere in their work and who are willing to do this tirelessly and without reward. That's what we have on our side. But in terms of trying to match up with the money and the political power of the nuclear industry, it's a very difficult thing.
I'm certainly working on some media angles, especially for next year, 2025, which is the 80th anniversary of the start of all this nuclear mess. Mm-hmm. Because what we're up against is that the media always leads in nuclear stories with the nuclear industry talking points. And maybe down at the bottom, if it's print, there's a paragraph that quotes somebody who's an activist saying, no, this really isn't a good idea. But we don't get that primacy in the articles. Why do you see it that the media is doing this?
I think there are two angles. The first is most journalists are working on extremely tight timelines. The media industry has been shrinking. There's very little money out there. And so these people have to file stories enormously fast. And they really, what they do is cutting and pasting from various press releases, you know, a quote here, a quote there. And then, of course, they get a token quote from somebody who will be described as an anti-nuclear activist, right, or something of that sort. And when you are described that way, you're already being discounted by the reader. So it's heavily tailored against us. But I think there's also, interestingly, if you were to ask people in the nuclear industry, they will probably say that the media is biased against them. And they would probably say, oh, you know, the media always talks about Chernobyl or Fukushima or all of these negative stories. They don't tell the great attributes of nuclear. And this is something which we have seen in the nuclear industry for many years now. They are complaining always that their great attributes are not recognized. They would love to say how they are a clean source of power, all within quotes, of course, how they are a reliable source of power, and the media doesn't highlight all of that. I think one reason why we both sides see the media in different ways as being against their interests is that the media, I think, has tries to operate within a narrow space to deal with the climate crisis, for example. They want to say that we can solve the climate problem just using some technologies here, rather than asking any larger questions about our society, about how it needs to change, about our politics, and so on and so forth. They don't want to ask any of these larger questions, so they like stories that make you feel good, that we can solve the problem without doing anything major. Change a few bulbs here, put on a solar panel on your roof, and build a few nuclear plants. And they see all of them in the same way. That, I think, is a fundamental challenge. And this has to do with also who controls the media. The media is controlled by very rich people who benefit from the current society, social setup. They don't want anything to be messed up here. You know, in my book, I also point out that this is part of the reason why we see billionaires like Bill Gates and Sam Altman and so on also promoting nuclear energy. They don't necessarily gain a lot of personal wealth from it, but they are really invested in making sure that nobody asks fundamental questions. So when there is, you know, Greta Thunberg or somebody like that who is asking deep changes in our society, they really do not like that. And I think the media also shares the same set of assumptions.
There's so much in your book to go over because you provide the basics and then you build upon them. One of the points you make early on is that the consequences of nuclear expansion will fall primarily on poor, marginalized, often indigenous communities. How intentional is that by the industry?
Intention is not something we can really know because we can't go inside their heads or we don't go inside their boardrooms to ask for us to hear them say that. But given that there is so much documentation about how bad uranium mining has been to indigenous communities, all of the other risks associated with this, there is no doubt that they ought to know about it. And if they are going ahead and planning their projects, you can either attribute intentionality or deliberately avoiding thinking about it and talking about it. And this again is typical, I think, of a lot of how we carry on activities in our society, which is try and outsource the harmful consequences onto some other population that is not going to be so powerful. Again, this is true for many other industries, like, you know, plastics, for example, or all kinds of other materials that we use. But in the case of the nuclear industry, I think they are trying to pretend to be clean. And therefore, having all of these environmental and health impacts not be seen in the, in by majority communities and, you know, being visited only on small, disempowered communities, which are typically geographically far away, helps them maintain that image more easily than if it had been, for example, if we have to construct the Yucca Mountain repository, not in Yucca Mountain, but in, let's say, in the Bay Area in California, things would be very different because the people there would be like, okay, what's happening here? What's subjecting myself and my descendants to? But when it's in Yucca Mountain, it's far away. The nuclear industry typically talks about it being a isolated or abandoned or unoccupied area that it becomes very easy for them to minimize or to hide the impacts.
Another part of hiding the impact, which you address in the book, is the fact that people don't understand about radiation, and that the nuclear industry, using the word you use, pretends that radiation is not linked to any kind of health prospect, or they diminish any concern about radiation. What do you say to that?
That is a very central element in much of the nuclear propaganda we see. The idea that low levels of radiation are not harmful, that there's a threshold below which either there is no health impact, or in the eyes of some really crazy people, that the health impact is actually beneficial. This is the hormesis, folks. It's a very central element, not just in the propaganda of the nuclear industry and its supporters, but even in the way that most regulation is done. So if you think about how a nuclear power plant is licensed for construction by, let's say, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission or the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, they have a set of standards. And in principle, what they are trying to show is that the radiation exposure of members of the public will be lower than a certain level. And why is that important? Because of the kind of pretense that at very low levels, the impact can be forgotten about. Of course, they would come back and say, well, everything we do has impacts and so on and so forth. But in the case of radiation, we know it is very special in that the impact continues in what scientists call a linear fashion, meaning that the effect is proportional to the dose to the lowest possible levels that we know of. That seems to be the most cautious way to approach the uncertainties that are associated with the low levels of radiation. And I'll also add that the nuclear industry has adopted the same kind of techniques as the tobacco industry used to use when they were trying to diminish the health impacts of smoking. And as one slogan said, doubt is our product. And the idea is to create the idea of uncertainty in people's minds. That radiation, maybe it's helpful, maybe it's not so bad. That's exactly what they want you to think about and hopefully forget about it. This is, I think, one of those cases again where the facts are on our side. There's scientific consensus among a lot of very established organizations, including the National Academy of Sciences, Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation Committees, and various groups of scientists. They have all put out reports and academic papers pointing out that the evidence suggests that the radiation risk never goes to zero until you get to a zero level of radiation. And the last thing I want to say is one of the other arguments that the nuclear industry often talks about is, oh, this is going to be small compared to all of the other radiation you're exposed to. This is why they like to use comparisons with X-rays or dental X-rays, or more absurdly, the idea is that when you eat bananas, you get a certain radiation dose. Or sometimes they also talk about how if you're sleeping with a partner, you get a certain radiation dose because all our bodies have a certain amount of potassium 40 and all these kinds of absurd ideas. Now, we can try and debate all of those things, and people have done that. But the thing to remember is that what is happening from natural sources is something we cannot avoid. We don't want to avoid sleeping with your partner if you have one, just because you're going to get a radiation dose. But the nuclear industry's dose, the radiation dose that you get from the nuclear industry, is totally egregious in the sense that we don't really find the electricity that it provides of great value. It's expensive. If it's a product that we really, really want, then we might argue that some amount of risk is something we should all undertake to be exposed to. But given that nuclear power is such a poor way of generating electricity, this whole thing is quite absurd, just in my opinion.
Physicist and author M. V. Ramana. We'll have a link up on our website to his book, Nuclear is Not the Solution, The Folly of Atomic Power in the Age of Climate Change. That will be under Nuclear Hot Seat episode number 693. And note that this is just the first half of our interview. The rest, which cover the debacle of small modular nuclear reactors and the nuclear energy-nuclear weapons connection, will be on next week's show. Meanwhile, To help you see the kind of lies the nuclear industry promotes about the building of new nuclear reactors, we have a link to the now-deleted but fortunately saved by Ramana 2014 Westinghouse animation, which showcases a new build of an AP1000 nuclear reactor in just 116 weeks. Note that the ability to achieve this is a total fiction, which is probably why Westinghouse took it down, but fortunately, we've got it.
Activists, shout out.
The film Saturn O'Fray Syndrome, Nuclear Power's Legacy, is an official selection at the 2024 edition of the prestigious Global Nonviolent Film Festival. The festival is running through October 13th, and online viewing is available for free. We will link to it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 693. It's a terrific film. I've seen it 3 times already. And wherever you find yourself in the battle against nuclear, you will find motivation, hope, and the modeling of response to help make your own work more powerful. And we are holding space in our hearts and whatever our belief systems are for Mary Olson. She is founder and head of Gender and Radiation Impact Project, and her impact on the entire nuclear conversation cannot be overestimated. Mary lives in Asheville, North Carolina, and since Hurricane Helene made landfall last Thursday, we have not heard from her. So if you have a good thought or religious practice to direct some energy towards her for her safety, please do so. When we get any further news, we will let you know. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, October 2nd, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered, you can get it via email every week as soon as it posts. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, look for the yellow box, though you really can't miss it. It pops right up in front of you. Put in your first name and an email address, and every week we will send you one, just one, email, which contains a link to that week's show and a short description of its content. That way, you need never miss a single Nuclear Hot Seat, and you will be on the front cutting edge of knowledge about what's happening in the nuclear world. Now, speaking of which, we need your help to stay on that front cutting edge. So if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that in an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything at all is deeply appreciated. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, the problem of nuclear weapons ends by its use or its elimination. That was said by Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations. So there you have it. You've just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. Thanks for being here, and whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.